Hello. Tonight, how the true story of an exotic dancer turned spy became the subject of Paulo Coelho's latest novel. We have a rare interview with the best-selling author. A review of the anime film Your Name, which has taken Japan by storm. Human rights lawyer Philippe Sands wins a prestigious literary prize and discusses the art of non-fiction. And the Turner Contemporary Gallery in Margate gets members of the local community involved in commissioning and making artworks.
My name's Alan. I'm cutting out these pieces that are going to be appliqued onto the large balls that are over there. There's 1,120 different pieces, and I must have handled most of them at least five times.
And we'll hear more from Margate in a moment. We begin with the Brazilian-born author Paulo Coelho, who's a publishing phenomenon, selling more than 200 million copies of his books worldwide. For his many, many followers on social media, Coelho is more than just a storyteller. His self-help messages contained in the novels make him something of a New Age guru. It's a reputation that has much to do with his most popular work, The Alchemist, a slender volume about a shepherd boy who risks everything to pursue his dreams. Coelho's latest book, The Spy, is inspired by the real-life story of Mata Hari, an exotic dancer, courtesan and alleged spy who plied her trade in Paris at the turn of the 20th century. Mata Hari was executed by the French for espionage during World War I. I spoke to Paulo Coelho on a line from Geneva, where he now lives.
Mata Hari was a character that always fascinated me a lot. She was one of our icons, the bad girl with these fancy dresses, also a spy, someone who was against the establishment. At the very beginning of this year, I was having a lunch with my lawyer, and he said that it was a mistrial. And I said, what, Mata Hari was not a spy? And he said, no, she was innocent. She was a scapegoat.
And we know this now, don't we, because the records of the trial in France have finally been released almost 100 years after her execution.
Yeah. My icon, you know. I realized that, yes, she was not a spy. She was just someone who went beyond her own limits.
A woman who slept with the wrong men at the wrong time.
Yeah, not only that, but also someone who trusted too much in her power of seduction, not knowing that men can be wicked.
Do you really think in your heart that if they were to choose someone to spy for Germany, France, or even Russia, they would choose someone who was constantly watched by the public? Does that not seem utterly ridiculous to you? Though at the moment I am a prisoner, my spirit remains free. Do you know what I'm going to do now, before I hear the footsteps in the corridor and the arrival of my breakfast? I am going to dance. I am going to remember every musical note and move my body to the rhythm because it shows me who I am. A free woman.
You begin your novel with the end of Mata Hari's life, her execution by firing squad in Paris in 1917, and you describe how, as she got ready to leave her prison cell, she drew on her black stockings, she stepped into a pair of high-heeled shoes adorned with silk laces, and she reached for her floor-length fur coat, which hung in the corner of her cell. Is that a count of her death from the official records?
It is from a newspaper, from the former Herald Tribune. The actual account, which surprised everybody, well, this was Mata Hari, you know. If I have to die, probably she thought, let me die as I always lived, with charm and elegance.
And she refused to wear the blindfold as she faced a firing squad.
Yeah. And she refused also to be tied to a stake, the poor soldiers that were there to kill someone. And she was very brave at the end. She was always very brave because Mata Hari was someone that when she was young, she was abused, she was raped, then she married the wrong man, she was beaten. Her son was murdered by the nanny. So she had a very tragic life. To the moment that she said, stop, I'm not like this, I am someone different. I want to live my dreams. And then she left everything behind. She went to Paris.
I mean, she essentially reinvented herself, didn't she? Made up a new name, pretended to be from Indonesia when, in fact, she was Dutch. You've said in the past that all of your books are born out of your own experience. What is it in your own life that you see in Matahari's?
I'm not telling you that I was channeling Matahari, huh? But Matahari is the story of so many women that have to face hard times in their lives. Same for my feminine part, you know. We have a common ground. I was also arrested and put in jail and tortured, being innocent.
This was under the military dictatorship in Brazil in the 1960s.
Yeah, in the 1970s.
She also ran away from a suffocating home life as a young woman in a small town in Holland, first to Indonesia with her first husband, and then later, as you say, to Paris to escape him. And you did a sort of similar thing, didn't you, by trying to run away from your parents and your home life and a very Catholic upbringing when you were young?
Yeah, from my parents. I was 3 times in a mental hospital because they thought that I was mad. They were very concerned about my future because I want to be an artist. We don't have artists in our family, you know. There are engineers, there are doctors, there are architects, but artists. So they put him in this mental institution. And yes, my dream was to be a writer. And then I started writing lyrics for songs. When they saw that in 1 year I had made more money than then in their lifetime, because I was a lyricist for a very successful singer in Brazil, then they relaxed.
Getting back to Matahari, you used quite a lot of archive sources, obviously, to write this book, including the testimony of the journalist Henry G. Wales at the time. Were you able to use any of the material verbatim without changing words?
30%, yes. And the fun is that MI5, the British Secret Service, they are now selling, you know, making money out of Matahari. Huh? The secret files, because they released it in 1997. So there is a lot of things I use in my book.
So you had to pay MI5 to get hold of the British records?
Yeah. And but yes, I had to pay them, and then I had to pay the German Secret Service also.
Now, Matahari always maintained that her dances were authentically Asian and had religious significance, but in fact they were just an exotic striptease with lots of veils. Was she able to get away with the nudity because there was such a fascination with Orientalism in Belle Époque Paris?
Striptease was forbidden, but Matahari was able to skip this rule because she gave an aspect of artistic nudity to her work. Was a good excuse to see a naked woman.
One of the reasons that your novels are so popular is that they read like fables. People see you as a kind of guru, and in some ways that they find your books, your novels, very helpful and the messages in them very useful. Is that your intention, or is your intention just to write a good story?
The intention is to write to understand myself. So I don't understand how can I be a guru if I don't even know myself. A book is a catalyst that awakens something that he or she already knows. I don't think they see me as a guru. They see me much more as a friend.
Paulo Coelho and his book The Spy comes out on Tuesday, and the reader was Katrina McFarlane. It was reported this week that Japan's answer to Walt Disney, the anime legend Miyazaki, is to come out of retirement once again to make another last film about a caterpillar. But in the meantime, a younger filmmaker has become the heir to his mantle. Makoto Shinkai, who worked alongside Miyazaki at Studio Ghibli on the Oscar-winning film Spirited Away. Shinkai's latest release, Your Name, is about two teenagers, a boy from Tokyo and a girl from a small traditional town in rural Japan, who temporarily trade places, waking up unexpectedly in each other's bodies. Your Name is a smash hit in Japan and was the highest grossing film of 2016. To review it, I'm now joined by the film critic Larushka Ivanzadeh. Larushka, let's start with this premise of the two kids from very different backgrounds, trading places and, of course, genders. Does it work?
Yeah, I think it works. I think I can't really recommend this film enough. I think people listening to it might be thinking, oh, Japanese anime, it's a bit niche. But this, I think, has tremendous appeal. I mean, it is being considered for the best animated movie at the Oscars. As you say, it was a massive smash. It's only just behind, I think, Frozen and Titanic in Japan. It's huge. And lots of the key scenes are set at twilight, which made me think this has the same appeal. It could appeal to a sort of YA young adult demographic like Twilight, because it is centered on a romance. And it's about a boy. He says, I'm searching for something, someone. There's a yearning romance at its heart. But yeah, there's a lot of very physical, very funny body swap comedy going on. The boy wakes up in the girl's body and keeps squeezing her breasts. And then what makes it funny and rather than pervy is her little sister runs in and goes, what are you doing? Why you seem to really enjoy your breasts at the moment. She's like, oh, no reason at all. And it's just got very funny little bits to it. It's
very topical, I think, in these days of gender fluidity,
yes.
Isn't it? You know, because when she's in his body, she, of course, he's quite a shy boy, but being a girl, she starts sort of talking to all his classmates and his colleagues at his after-school job.
Yeah, the older woman, it's a more sophisticated woman he has a crush on that he always just keeps fumbling around and just not getting a date with. She manages to secure him a date by being, you know, really relaxed and chatty and speaking to a woman to woman.
Exploring his feminine side. Now, it's got a great twist in it, so I don't want to give too much away, but I would class this as a post-Fukushima film, because there is a disaster in it, and there's quite a strong sci-fi element, isn't there, about sort of time and memory.
Oh, definitely. Although we've been sort of describing it as a body swap comedy, it's like a time travel romance, a disaster movie, a sci-fi fantasy. It's got so many genres bundled up into this. It does have a preoccupation that I think lots of Japanese, especially the Studio Ghibli films that you mentioned, a lot of them talk about natural disaster, recognition of the past. This country girl that we're talking about, she tends a Shinto shrine in the country, which is the traditional Japanese religion. So there's a lot of elements going on here about the past, yes, tradition, about loss, about death, about these cosmic elements. And it balances this amazing, particularly beautifully and realised, dazzling cosmic elements with the very internal and personal, highly personal elements.
Because I like the contrast between his life in Tokyo and her life in this traditional town. Mm-hmm. So that when she first sees Tokyo, it's almost like she's encountering the West.
Yeah.
And she goes to a cafe and
she's
has
so
pancakes.
About cafe. No, and it's so gleaming, sort of photorealist Tokyo world that is contrasted with this very dreamy, sublimely beautiful. When I was watching the screening just at the beginning, someone literally whispered, "It's so beautiful," at the beginning, out loud. I've never really had that in a screening before.
Is he the heir to Miyazaki, do you think? I mean, can you see Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle in this work?
I do. I mean, as I said, I can see sort of traditional Japanese cultural preoccupations coming through. And the depth of what he's doing. I mean, this is real artistry going on here in all senses. I think the end becomes very confusing. I don't know about you, but by the end, I was like, what is going on? It was like the end of Back to the Future times a million times another film. And I think he's still got a way to go. I don't think this is like the top of his work. He's only 43. You were mentioning Miyazaki. You know, he's retired. I think this is the seventh time he's coming out of retirement. He's 73. So this guy's got 30 years of work at least ahead of him.
Absolutely,
and I think he's going to accomplish marvels.
He's very clever. I mean, yes, an understanding of quantum mechanics and parallel universes might
and
help.
And it's got everything. Nazar, yes, Phil.
Larushka Yuvanzadeh, and thank you very much. And your name is released in selected cinemas next week, Certificate 12A. Last night, the human rights lawyer Philippe Sands won the UK's top award for non-fiction, the Bailey Gifford, formerly known as the Samuel Johnson Prize. His book, East West Street, is about two prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials. Hirsch Lauterpacht developed the concept of crimes against humanity, and Raphael Lemkin, the idea of genocide. But it's also a very personal story involving Sands' own grandfather, because by strange coincidence, all three men came from the same Ukrainian border town. Sands joined me earlier today with Kathy Rensenbrink, who wrote The Last Act of Love, a memoir about her late brother, to discuss the art of writing non-fiction. I put it to Philippe that the subtitle of his book, East West Street, On the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity, suggested a rather dry academic tone, whereas in fact it reads more like a quest or even a piece of detective fiction.
The subtitle is problematic because it makes it sound like a very boring, turgid legal book. And I hope that it's not. It's a family story. I wanted to know about my grandfather and I wanted to know about the origins of what I do, actually. I do cases about crimes against humanity and genocide. And I wanted to find a different voice. For a lawyer for whom you're trained to strip passion and emotional and the personal out of everything you do, it was tough to do.
And yet, on the other hand, John Mortimer was famously a working barrister and a successful writer. Barristers are, in some ways, natural storytellers, aren't they?
I think a lot of the skills that were needed in writing this book, the research skills and the presentational skills, are ones that come out of the courtroom. I think that is right. We are wannabe storytellers and actors when we appear before judges, and all of a sudden you're presented with a script you can write in a literary non-fiction, as I think the genre is now called, and you have the freedom to do that. But you're drawing on that hinterland.
Cathy, Philippe has mentioned the phrase literary non-fiction. Have you detected a shift in non-fiction over the years into a more narrative style that mimics novels?
I think it's a broad church. I always feel memoirs have rather more in common with novels than they do with substantial works of history, politics and current affairs. What I find fascinating about Philippe's book is that the one is folded into the other. So it is an entirely engrossing, rather page-turning read, and the research methodology becomes part of a story, and a detective story at that. So I have been turning the pages with great anticipation, and I'm quite a lazy reader of the harder non-fiction. I do prefer to lose myself in a story, which this very much is.
Where does the art lie in non-fiction? Because it has to be true. So where is there room for the imagination?
If you want someone to listen to your story, you better make sure you're telling a good one. The more difficult your story is, then the more you probably owe it to your reader to pay some attention to both the art and possibly also the craft of how you tell a story. Certainly for me, I think the writing of a memoir might involve sticking it all down on the page, but the editing is really where you think about how somebody is consuming what it is you want to say.
Kathy's absolutely right. This was an enormously difficult book to write because you're dealing with four characters, two crimes, a city, over a period of 40 years. When I wrote the first draft, which was then sent out and bought by Knopf, it's 125,000 words, and I told the story chronologically, all four characters interwoven from 1914 to 1946. And Vicky Wilson said, this could be a wonderful book, but I'm making a condition of buying it that you restructure it completely because the intelligent reader can't deal with this information in that quantity presented in this way. And so this is how you will do it. You'll deal first with your grandfather, then you'll deal with Lauterpacht, originator of crimes against humanity, then you'll deal with Lemkin, originator of genocide, then you'll deal with Frank, Hitler's lawyer, and then the reader will be able, in the final part of the book, in the Nuremberg trial, where you bring the four stories together, to deal with all that information. It was a brilliant piece of advice from a fantastic editor. And so structure became incredibly important.
Cathy, like Philippe, you have also written a very personal book, a memoir about your brother's catastrophic brain injury, a personal book, but one which casts a light on bigger issues. How did you balance the forensic with the emotional?
Actually, it was my intention to put it in a drawer, to write it out for myself and put it in a drawer. And gradually things changed. And there's this brilliant moment during an event when somebody said to me, did you realise you were writing a socially significant book? And I said, no. Is it? I had no idea at that point. And it was actually the response of other people that made me see that the story of what happened to my brother had wider social implications. But I think that's because I think I'm a novelist by nature, and I'm an accidental memoirist, which I think would be a good title for a novel. But I'm an accidental memoirist because I had to tell the truth, really. I kept trying to write it as a novel, kept trying to force it into a fictional shape, but it didn't really work. And I think a lot of memoirs are written by novelists who have the misfortune to have a story that won't fit into a novel. And that's what I feel happened to me, really.
That so resonates. At one point, I was really facing a difficulty. I said to my editor, Vicky Wilson, in this section, I need to make up a conversation between the two men to imagine what Lauterpacht and Lemkin would have said to themselves. They never met. And Vicky said, absolutely not. The moment you introduce fiction into this book, it's over. It's dead. You cannot do that. So what you've just said, Cathy, completely resonates.
So writing fiction would be a lot easier because you could just make stuff up.
Well, right now I sit at the cusp because actually my very, very favourite character in this book is an extraordinary lady called Elsie Tilney, who is an evangelical Christian missionary whom I learned about in researching the book and who's the lady who brought my mother to safety in July 1939. And a number of people, including some very well-known novelists, have said that should be a short novel. And my dear friend and competitor in this prize, Hisham Mattar, says what I must do next is write a novel about Miss Tilney, and in particular her experience at Vittel, where she was interned by the Nazis for 4 years with 2,500 other American, Canadian and British women. And I would love to do that, but frankly, I find it terrifying because I'm able to deal with facts, but the idea of leaving the facts behind and finding that new space is sort of scary.
I think you should give it a go. I wouldn't say this to many non-fiction writers, to be honest, but I would love to read a novel written by you. And I think you can tell reading this book that you have a novelist's slant at the way you look at things. So
I'm really encouraged by what you're saying. That really excites me.
Well, let's hope he does write that novel. Philippe Sands and Cathy Renson-Brink. And Philippe's prize-winning book is East West Street, on the origins of genocide and crimes against humanity. And don't let the subtitle put you off. And Cathy's book is The Last Act of Love. And Philippe will be donating his prize money to refugee charities. If you listen carefully, you can probably hear the sound of the sea, certainly the wind, because I'm in Margate. I've come here to see an exhibition at the Turner Contemporary Gallery. That opened 5 years ago and it's brought almost a million new visitors to this seaside town. But it was also conceived as a place where the local community could meet and work on projects. So the piece I'm going to see today is a large-scale installation of three monumental figures made out of textiles. It's designed by the Nottingham-based artist Kashif Nadeem Chowdhury, but it was commissioned by a group of 20 local artists and craftspeople called the Turner Contemporary Studio Group. And they have spent much of the past year helping Nadeem to make this installation. And I'm just going to go inside now because they're actually in the process of installing it and putting the final touches on.
My name's Kashif Nadeem Chowdhury. On this table over here, we have Maggie, who's on the sewing machine. She's doing applique. And then sitting around the table, we have Mandy, we have Gay, we have Alan, and they're all cutting out applique shapes. On the next table, we have Sharon, and Sharon is actually working on some balls, which are covered in Margate sand, so they're Margate sandy balls, and these will be hanging from one of the skulls, one of the headpieces.
Now, just explain the process of this to me. So the Turner Studio Group, 19 local artists, come to you and they commission you to make a piece. To what extent do you design a piece that works with their particular skills?
Initially, when I have an idea, it's always a kind of a skeleton of an idea, if you like. An archetype is what I call it. So I came with this archetype of an idea, I presented to the group, and then they chose me. And then over the course of the year, I've kind of had this dialogue with them, and they've kind of learned different skills from me, but also what was really important to give them a sense of empowerment is that I use their skills as well, and they have a say in how the work looks and what it feels like. So it's a two-way dialogue that we've had all the way along.
Who's in charge, though? I mean, obviously artists have worked with in studios with people helping them ever since the Renaissance, but do you get the final say on what the piece looks like?
Well, I mean, I kind of consider myself to be more of a conductor, I think, in a way. I guess I do get the final say, if you like, but after a lot of discussion as well, I think, which has been very fundamental to the whole project.
And presumably part of the attraction of working with you was that you've always worked in textiles. You come from a family of tailors, don't you?
That's right, yeah. The skills I learned came from my mum, came from my grandma, my aunts. There is a tradition, textiles, that skills are passed down in that way. So that's why it was great to work with the group. I mean, having the opportunity to work with 20 other people and to share not only their sort of creative skills, but their life experience as well. Because these people, you know, they're all of an age, if you like. So it's been fantastic.
So what's the average age of the group, would you say?
Well, the youngest person is 10 years my senior, and I'm 40. And there were two people in their late 80s as well. It's made by the people of Thanet, by local people. I think that's really important. And I think it's really going to sow some fantastic seeds within the community, I hope.
OK, well, I'm going to go over there and ask some of these people what they're doing.
My name's Alan Longley, and I'm cutting out these pieces that are going to be appliqued onto the large balls that are over there. I think, what was the figures? I think there's 1,120 different pieces, and I must have handled each, or most of them, at least five times.
Do you think this makes a difference to how people locally see the gallery?
It should do. For me, it's been a lifeline since retiring, moved down here. Then this place opened, and Yeah, it's been a lifeline.
What was your previous job?
The last job I had was working for London Underground.
Well, that's quite a change. I now move to the next table, and there are two ladies sitting here with a bright purple snake, I would say, on your laps. What's your name?
I'm Lynn.
Lynn, and what are you making here?
This is going to be a vine that's going to go through one of the skulls.
Are you an artist yourself?
No, I'm a maker. I'm a spinner and a knitter.
And tell us specifically about working with Nadim on this project. What's that been like?
Labour intensive. There's been a lot of work, but he's always listened to our ideas. He's always been receptive, and that's how I got my spinning and knitting into it. So the whole project has changed over the time we've been doing it.
So originally there wasn't any spinning and knitting in the original installation,
no.
And you said, look, these are my skills,
can we try?
And
do. Yeah. I knew what he wanted to do with the vine specifically out there, and because we couldn't find the materials, I said, well, I can do that. So I did.
Now, we're in the entrance hall of the Turner Contemporary, and it's a wonderful space. We're looking straight out at the sea. There are these massive windows that are probably, 40 foot high and so on. Nadim, just tell me what's happening here right now. What are we looking at?
So this is a large-scale vine that's going up on one of my Three Graces. The sculpture is called the Three Graces, so we have two genies with two lots of technicians in them, and they're actually raising the vine up, I'd say about maybe 60 or so feet off the ground, and they are currently fixing it around the stained glass window, if you like, which is sort of suspended.
Now, this installation is going to be made up of three sculptures made out of a sort of a variety of different textiles. Tell us what each one is. It's called the Three Graces.
So the work draws upon the kind of the Western myths of the Three Graces from Greek mythology. But also I come from an Islamic background, and I'm interested in pre-Islamic Arabia. And in pre-Islamic Arabia, it was a pantheon of gods, and there were three daughters of Allah that were also worshipped. And so it kind of draws upon that Eastern myth also.
Give us a sense of the scale. How big is each piece?
I'd say they're probably about sort of 8 to 9 metres in length and 6 or 7 in width and maybe 6 or 7 in depth as well. So it's quite a large scale space. So the work is also very large scale as well.
It's wonderful looking at this group of people working on sort of multicoloured fabrics and materials against the sort of slate grey sky of the channel. I should say it's a rather rainy day in Margate.
Absolutely.
How's it felt working in this sort of atmosphere with all these other people?
Very emotional, I think, because it's been a year-long project, and essentially this is kind of the end of that project, or, you know, coming to the end, seeing everything come together. But also what I'm interested in is creating works which are very visually, very rich. I'm inspired by things like Mughal architecture, like Bollywood cinema, by Elizabethan costumes.
I should say that all the works costumes. Are incredibly colourful. It's like a kaleidoscope of colour here.
That rich kind of vocabulary, I'm really sort of interested in that. Actually seeing it all come together, it's very intense, seeing all those different shapes and colours and forms. But knowing that we've worked on them as well for a whole year, it's been quite emotional at points, and I've had to stop myself from kind of tearing up a little bit, which I think I will do on the opening day. And I think it's fair enough, because it has been a very intense project, and yeah, a lot of love has gone into it.
Atiri Kashif Naveen Chowdhury, and Three Graces opens at the Turner Contemporary Gallery in Margate this Saturday. On tomorrow's programme, John Wilson will reveal the winner of the Hepworth Prize for Sculpture. But we leave you now with a small tribute to the jazz pianist and singer Mose Allison, whose death was announced today at the age of 89.
You're sitting there yakking right in my face. I guess I'm gonna have to put you in your place. You know, if silence was golden, you couldn't raise a dime. Because your mind is on vacation and your mouth is working overtime.